From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. On today's show, as many of us prepare to gather around a Thanksgiving table, we consider the surprising incidence of hunger on college campuses.
Plus, a little-known part of Wisconsin's cranberry heritage.
It's got this bill and then this head shape that looks exactly like a crane. So they're really not cranberries, they're craneberries. We've been saying it wrong all these years.
Later, a couple of radio tastings, food writer Jeanette Hurt brings us some Wisconsin cheese and an important suggestion for serving it.
Let it warm up to room temperature. One of the reasons cheese was invented was to prevent the spoiling of milk or to use the milk. So it's okay to bring it up to room temperature.
And a visit with the founders of an artisanal tonic company in Milwaukee. Lake Effect is next. First, the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. For many, Thanksgiving is all about the food. Turkey, mashed potatoes, gravy, more potatoes. Every family's spread is different. But the common thread is an abundance of grub. But the holiday also asks us to think about those less fortunate, because not everyone is able to eat three meals a day, let alone a big feast.
College students are one of the biggest groups that have trouble getting enough to eat. As higher education has become a goal for more kids, a more socioeconomically diverse set of students are showing up on college campuses in Milwaukee and around the country. And it's forcing many schools to stock campus food pantries and rethink meal plans.
Ashley Hall is a recent college graduate. As a high school student in Milwaukee, she received free and reduced price meals. But when she got to college, she was on her own, and finding enough nutritious food proved to be a challenge.
Hall now works as a coach with College Possible, a Milwaukee-based organization helping low-income students attend college. As she told Lake Effect's Rachel Morello, her own experiences with food have shaped how she helps students today.
So I went to high school at Milwaukee School of Languages on the north side of Milwaukee, and I was really into playing sports there. So I played volleyball, soccer, a little bit of basketball. So I knew when I went to college that like I wanted to go somewhere that I was going to play sports. So I applied to Lakeland College, and I got in contact with a soccer coach right away, and I got accepted, and I got on the team, so I just went there.
Tell me a little bit about when you were in high school at the School of Languages. What were meals like for you during the day?
So Milwaukee School of Languages is a middle school and a high school, and when I was in middle school, they didn't offer breakfast, so I ate breakfast at home, which was cereal. But when I got to high school, they started offering breakfast as a part of your lunch package. So I got reduced lunch or free lunch most of the time, so I got free breakfast. So then I always ate breakfast at school. It was like just a routine. Breakfast, first period, lunch, fifth period, and that was just it. It just became a habit.
Sometimes there's a stigma associated with programs like free or reduced lunch. Did you ever feel uncomfortable that that was something that you took part in?
When I was younger, it felt really uncomfortable to me to like know that this is only for kids, that their parents don't have enough income that get placed on this. And then I thought like, well, what are my friends going to think about me? That I don't have money. And then it came just that most of my friends were in the same bracket. They were in either free or reduced lunch too. So as I grew up into high school, I realized that doesn't make who I am. It just is a part of who I am. And I just had to learn to live with it and to make it a positive thing.
Was it something that was just in your own head, or did you have experiences that made you feel that way?
Just in my own head. So most of the time, other students didn't know if you were on free or reduced lunch. Like, I knew, so then I thought everyone else knew. That it was like a sign over my head, this person has free lunch. And unless I told people, oh, I get free lunch, people didn't care.
So how did that change once you got to college, once you went to Lakeland? What was it like for you doing meals there?
So it was completely different. When I was in soccer, it was like you get up with your soccer team and you go and you have breakfast and you have lunch together. And then when school started, I didn't eat breakfast, which was weird because it stopped becoming a routine, right? I would get up and enough time to go to class, But if I brought like a yogurt to class, then that was it. I didn't make sure that like, oh, I have to go and eat breakfast. It just stopped becoming a routine.
Was that something you were getting in a cafeteria? Were you being provided that because you were on the team? Talk to me about how you got the food.
So with the soccer team, we'd go into the cafeteria and we'd have to like swipe for our meals, which we got a packet because we started early than the other students did. But once school hit, you were using your own meal swipes depending on what your package was. And my package was, I think I had like 100 meals for a semester, which is crazy to think that like, okay, so now I have to be careful. How am I spending my meals and not thinking, oh, I can go eat dinner every day and I'm going to be fine.
So 100 meals for a whole semester. That's all you had on that plan?
Yeah, that was it.
I'd have to imagine, I can't do the math that quickly, but I'd have to imagine that doesn't even add up to 3 meals a day.
No. If you add up, I had about like 115 meals that I could get food with. And then I had about $300 spending dollars that I could only use in the store.
Did you go through that pretty quickly? How quickly do you think you went through it?
My first semester, I went through it, I want to say within like the first 2 months, I was already done with the money. And my second semester, I was like, okay, I'm going to try and not spend. I think I lasted until about the third month.
Wow. So what did you do once that stuff ran out? Were you shopping for everything on your own?
Yeah, I was shopping for things on my own, or I was borrowing meals from other students that had plenty that they weren't using and using their meals.
Do you have like a ballpark estimate of how much money you think you spent once you had to do it on your own?
I think I want to say that I would go to Walmart at least once a week to get snacks for my room, and I would spend at least about $50 to $100 at least.
Every week?
Every week.
And what kind of stuff were you able to buy?
I would buy things to make sandwiches, so like bread, peanut butter and jelly, ramen, which is like for sure a college thing to buy.
Yeah, definitely.
And I would buy fruit snacks or like chips or things that would quick that I could just take and run.
How does that stuff compare to the stuff that you were eating when you were swiping for meals in the cafeteria?
It definitely didn't fill me up. Where like when I was swiping for the cafeteria, it was a buffet. So like I could go up whenever I wanted to and not have to worry about not getting full. We're like making a sandwich, I was constantly eating, or ramen, I was constantly eating, constantly hungry.
Right. And did you, when you were, I guess, paying for all this extra food while you were a first semester freshman, how were you paying for it? Were you working for extra money to pay for it? Were you calling home, or how, give me an idea of
how
that was.
So I had an on-campus job that would also like help me, but it was enough to go by, but I was only working 10 hours a week. It really wasn't anything, and I was working at minimum wage, so like $7.25, which wasn't enough. It was enough to kind of get me by, but it just wasn't working. I had money saved up, and I was just spending the money that I was supposed to be saving to spend for like books or whatnot. And as a freshman, you're not realizing that this money that you're spending isn't supposed to be spent the way you're spending it. So it definitely was hard. My second semester, I definitely was like, I have to fix something. I have to do something. It just came to spending wisely and figuring out when you can eat, what meals. Are you going to eat lunch today and dinner, or are you going to eat just dinner? A lot of times I would just figure out what I could do to like hold myself over to dinner, or just eat some things that I had in my room, like ramen for lunch, and then wait till dinner.
Mm-hmm. Was there a food pantry on campus that you could take advantage of?
No.
Do you wish ever that you had had something like that?
Oh, definitely, yeah.
So we're talking about your freshman, your first two semesters, right? How did things change as you moved through school?
My sophomore year through my senior year, I worked at the coffee shop on campus, which one, I was spending less of my money because I was getting the coffee for free for working there, and I was getting snacks there for free. So that definitely helped me not spend money. So it definitely helped. And then my senior year, I was working in the cafeteria. So I was then a food server. So if I would work for dinner, I'd get dinner for free because I was working.
That was probably a huge deal, huh?
That whole meal. Definitely. So it helped me to figure out, well, where can I get in? Like if I'm working at this job, then that's going to help me save here. Like if I'm working in the cafeteria for dinner, then I'm saving my swipe for dinner. I can use that for more lunches.
This sounds so different than what you were just describing in high school, that it was all right there. You didn't have to think about it. And this took a lot of thinking, it sounded like.
Definitely, yeah.
Wow. How, now that you've graduated, congratulations, by the way.
Thank you.
You just graduated last fall, right?
Yeah, I graduated in December.
How has your life after college been? Have you continued to sort of have to try to figure things out, not a semester by semester anymore, but how is it different?
So I moved back home. So my grandparents own a duplex, and my husband and I live above it. but it's still like we're on our own. So it definitely came a time where we were still living like college students, not making dinners like we should be, or not going out and buying groceries like we should be. And I think it really took us a flip of the switch to basically be like, okay, we're adults, we have adult jobs. We have to stop living like we're still in college and going and buying groceries and coming home and cooking full meals where we can have leftovers and have those for lunch and not going to like Qdoba or wherever to get lunch instead.
Do you guys do budgeting or anything like that?
We do budgeting now. So now it's like, okay, this is how much we're getting paid and this is groceries. When we weren't budgeting, it was, oh, well, we'll just go and buy whatever groceries we think we need. And it just was no organization.
So the kids that you work with College Possible now, do you guys talk about food as in terms of the larger scope of what they have to consider when they're picking a school?
That hasn't come up. I don't tell them, oh, you have to think about it, like meal plans and all of this, because I don't want to scare them right away.
When you go back and think of your overall college experience, how high on your list of like worries or stress would you rank food compared to like homework and all that other stuff?
That would probably be like my third thing. School's all obviously going to be a high stress because that's what you're working with the most. But when you run out of meals and you can't figure out what to do for dinner, then that's definitely going to be another high priority. School takes a high priority and you're forgetting that like college is also supposed to be fun time.
And then food, third on the list.
And then food.
Ashley Hall is a coach with College Possible. She spoke with Lake Effect's Rachel Morello.
We continue our Thanksgiving edition with a look at Wisconsin's cranberry tradition when Lake Effect continues on WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. We're talking about food in various ways on this Thanksgiving edition of the show, so naturally it makes sense to visit with our regular food contributor, Kyle Cherick, who says Thanksgiving is perhaps his favorite holiday.
Cherick talked with Lake Effect's Bonnie North about Wisconsin's connection to an important part of many Thanksgiving tables, the cranberry, and also why he likes the holiday so much.
It's the great American food holiday, and it isn't laden with patriotism or religiosity. It's just about being together and about breaking bread, or a turkey leg, as it may be.
Or all of those things.
Yeah, but it's this one of these great, I mean, it's a holiday that everyone in the country, if you enjoy eating something yummy, can get behind.
Right. It's probably one of the true holidays that unites us.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
You mentioned turkey, you mentioned bread, all wonderful things. There's, you know, lots of staples that people have for the Thanksgiving meal. But one of the things, and I'm from New England, so this is very near and dear to my heart.
Cranberries.
Cranberries.
Yeah.
And, you know, the cranberry bogs of Massachusetts, of Cape Cod,
are
famous. I mean, we grew up eating the real thing, not just the jellied thing that came in a can that kind of jiggled.
And I'll explain how that happened.
Right.
But, yeah.
But, you know, Wisconsin, as we know, is now one of the big producers of cranberries.
Right.
So let's go back. Cranberries were something that the Native Americans were using.
Yeah, I mean, those bogs in throughout New England are original, and the Native Americans cultivated them. But there's really only seven fruits, per se, that are original to North America that before the conquistadors or the Vikings or any of those people landed here were growing. And that's grapes and cranberries, pawpaws, persimmons, something called a mayhaw, which is sort of like a cross between an apple and a pear, berries and cherries. And that's what the natives had as far as fruits to eat. So cranberries were really, first of all, they're part of the heather family, which blows me away. And there's 35,000 species of the heather family.
I had no idea they were heather.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
And they can grow. They're invasive, really. Well, they're not invasive, but they're foreign to Wisconsin, just as corn, which came out of Mesoamerica, is foreign to the Midwest. Or it wasn't originally grown here. It certainly didn't hop a bus and make its way up. So when we talk about cranberries, but now, of course, they're grown all the way from northern Georgia, from the mountains in Georgia, up the East Coast and as far west as Minnesota. So all you really need is the right temperatures and an area that you can flood. And I'll get into some of the ecological issues with that.
They're bogs, and
right.
So they need to grow in a lot of water.
Correct. Yeah. And there's both a good size and bad size to that in our current food culture and ecology about a cranberry bog. But Maine really owned the cranberry action until the 1830s, just as New York, I know the beer folks that listen to the show, know that they owned the hop action. I mean, they were the producer for the nation. And then in the 1830s, they came to Wisconsin and started being cultivated. The Algonquin word for cranberry is Attaqua, which has no relation in their language to aqua, you know, the water. But I think it's interesting that, you know, they grow in water. But the name cranberry came from the Germans and the Dutch that came over originally to your old stomping grounds, the East Coast, because the flower looks like a crane. It's got this bill and then this head shape that looks exactly like a crane. So they're really not cranberries. They're craneberries. We've been saying it wrong all these years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, and cranberries, of course, were a way for the native peoples to get vitamin C.
Oh, hugely.
You know, it was because there were no oranges.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
know, there wasn't citrus.
When we talk about the Thanksgiving meal, cranberries are fascinating because they are one of the few things that were actually eaten at that original cranberry meal, whereas the turkey, you know, they would have had mincemeat pies or things like that, but they would not have roasted or baked a whole turkey the way that we do. And the turkey, as we talked about last year, really made its way from Mexico through Turkey and Europe and England to high-style dining rooms and then back to America. It ran this loop, and so the quote-unquote colonists at the first Thanksgiving would be saying, what's with this huge bird on your table now? Cranberries they would have recognized, but probably in the form that it would have been mashed up with other game and dried into either cakes or pemmican. So they would have mixed it with some of the grains, or they would have probably cornmeal, to be honest, or mashed it with deer meat and made pemmican, which sustained the Native Americans, sustained the Mountain Men. In fact, there was a revolt by the Native Americans and the Mountain Men in 1814 on the Eastern Seaboard because there was a settlement where they had a food shortage, and the governor said, no more food can be exported from this area. Well, the Mountain Men lived on this stuff, and the Native tribe created it for them. It was a form of commerce. So they literally sacked the settlement over this, which, I mean, imagine, you're starving. You're from God knows where in Europe, and now natives and mountain men are attacking you because of dried treats, basically, that sustains them.
Because of pemmican.
Because of pemmican, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The original colonists, their form of cooking was pretty uninventive. I mean, they were still in the Middle Ages. So though the natives used cranberries for dyes and as poultices and all manner, I mean, it was really the way that we think about the Plains Indians working the buffalo through everything. The Eastern Seaboard Indians worked cranberries through absolutely everything. It was very important to them. And it wasn't really in vogue until about the 1660s, 70s, when the English brought honeybees over. So that was the sweet. Their honeybees are imported to America, which...
And see, I didn't know that
blows
either.
My mind, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we had bees, obviously, as pollinators, but the honeybees then created an opportunity for mass honey and sweetness, and cranberries started being used in cooking. There was that sweet-tart kind of trade-off, and they grew, and they came in vogue in such a major way that better households had cranberry sauces on absolutely everything. If you could afford meat or fish or even lobster, you were serving it, and this is gross in case of lobster, with cranberry sauce on it, which is fairly disgusting.
Not a taste I would go for. I love lobster and I love cranberry sauce,
right.
But the two of them together, not so much.
Yeah, keep them miles apart.
I would think the cranberry would just completely overwhelm the lobster.
You would think.
Yeah.
Yeah, but maybe there were so many lobster in those days, it just didn't matter.
Or they were stronger flavored or something. Who knows?
There's a 19th century humorist that I found that wrote a great, he was sort of like a micro Mark Twain in a Boston newspaper that wrote, the sauce that seizes up on every well-laid plate is cranberry. Which, mean, it's just...
Oh, dear.
Yeah, so it was a little bit of Voltaire there for Boston society and their use of cranberry sauce. In 1912, it hits in a can. There's an attorney that realizes that people would like to have this cranberry flavor and the vitamins and so forth shipped across America. Through an advertising campaign, it became part of Thanksgiving. That was a major thrust, and that ridiculous log with the ripples in it straight out of the can became de rigueur at our Thanksgiving dinners.
So had cranberries fallen out of favor before that? Had it not been used for Thanksgiving?
Well, they really weren't used for Thanksgiving before that. They had been used, like I said, in better families to serve during the 19th century. But then with World War I, and, you know, there's about 60, 80 years of changing tastes where cranberries really weren't on the American table. It wasn't until they were inexpensive and they were canned and jellied and that crazy shape, that kind of Kwanzaa hut of redness.
That wobble.
Yeah, exactly, came. and it was an advertising thrust. And that same attorney created the cooperative that is now Ocean Spray. And they're a 900-pound gorilla in the cranberry world. There are very few independent producers that are not part of Ocean Spray. And we can talk about this in northern Wisconsin, where it's the country's largest cranberry-producing region. And almost everyone belongs to Ocean Spray. And I don't want to, you know, get political, but anybody can Google Ocean Spray antitrust or Ocean Spray lawsuit. And there's been a lot of issues with price fixing or alleged, and some of the producers within the cooperative feeling that they weren't being dealt with fairly.
Who knew that cranberries...
Right.
Had this whole, like, antitrust thing going on. I don't tend to think of cranberries in that way.
Well, when you do think about American foodways now, Ocean Spray and its various subsidiaries in partnership with PepsiCo since the 1990s has put out anywhere between 6 to 12 new products a year with cranberry in it. So when you have this vast, I mean, it's just economics, supply
sure.
and demand, and then you need to control the price. It could be sugar. It could be coffee. It could be maple syrup. It could be gasoline. It could be anything, that there's a lot of money in it, and you want to control those resources. But then you keep creating new avenues of consumerism. And to your point, yeah, cranberries. We don't think about it. It's insidious, but it's part of our daily life.
So when you're eating your craisins,
that's right.
Just think of that.
It's true. That's a perfect example of a utterly made up food that didn't exist and now are probably in cupboards of who knows, you know, half of America, or eaten muffins or cookies or what have you. Environmentally, it's very interesting because cranberry bogs, at least in Wisconsin, happen when you take an area that they'll grow well and you basically divert rivers and streams to flood it temporarily, right? So that, you could argue, is not a positive for the rivers and streams. On the other hand, the herbicides and pesticides that flow into that bog really affect the cranberries. So there's been a lot of environmentalism might on the side of the growers to say, hey, we can't have these unhealthy things in our rivers and streams. That, we would say, is a general good. The other side is you're taking oftentimes wetlands, which after the coral reefs are the single most fragile and complex ecosystems we have on this globe, and you're flooding them often to grow cranberries, so there's a lot of displacement of wildlife. On the other side, though, when you created a bog, you buy tons of acreage around it to insulate it, which hedges against McMansions and lots of other development. So, you know, the cranberry bogs in northern Wisconsin and in Maine and in the eastern seaboard and some in Minnesota, you can kind of come at them from two different angles. Some aspects are really great for the environment and others are fairly deteriorative. So, I don't know. Everyone can form their own conclusions, but they should eat cranberry more consciously and drink the juice more consciously moving forward. Yeah.
Well, I'm happy to eat cranberries.
On Thanksgiving, we're all expecting you to.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's a good
claim
thing.
That as your national right, for goodness sake.
All right. All right. Well, Kyle, I hope you and your family have a wonderful cranberry-laden Thanksgiving.
I'm looking for a big meal and a nap at 5.
There you go. There you go. Sounds good to me. And we will talk next month.
Cool.
Kyle Cherik is host of the public television show Wisconsin Foodie and our regular food contributor. He talked with Lake Effect's Bonnie North.
Whether you're still putting together your holiday meal plans or thinking about the holiday meals to come in the next month, we're going to virtually sample a couple of items that might make your menu when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. So we've talked about food on today's show, and now we're going to taste some food that might make it onto your holiday table, whether it's Thanksgiving or Christmas or another festive occasion. Unfortunately, it's a little hard to do that through the radio.
So I will be your proxy for this next segment. Food writer and occasional Lake Effect contributor Jeanette Hurt stopped by with a bag full of cheese that is a cut or two, or maybe 10, above that Velveeta that's sitting in the back of your fridge. Great to see you.
It's great to see you too, Mitch.
All right, so before we get to actually tasting the cheese, I want to ask you a little bit about technique, because if you go out and get a high-quality piece of cheese from a grocery store or a cheese shop, you don't want to leave pieces of it lying around your kitchen floor or falling off the dining room table. So what's the best way to start getting it into smaller pieces?
Well, the first thing you want to do with a really good cheese, especially like an aged cheddar, let it warm up to room temperature. One of the reasons cheese was invented was to prevent the spoiling of milk or to use the milk. So it's okay to bring it up to room temperature, and you're not going to die, and you're not going to suffer cheese poisoning of any kind. So bring it up to room temperature. That's the first thing. The second thing, and our listeners cannot see me holding up my two tools here, is to use a proper cheese knife. The one that I am using right here looks a little bit like a mini cleaver.
Right, it's like a teeny meat cleaver.
Tiny, teeny meat cleaver, but it's just for cheese. It's actually designed for cheese, and it's for harder cheeses that you want to slice or cut off hunks. But you also don't want to, as you said, leave the crumbles all over the place, especially for the cheddar that we have today, which is Hook's 15-year cheddar. It's at least $50 a pound. Hard to come by, and I remember the first time I was cutting off such hunks from such a cheese, and I figured the dog got $15 worth of crumbs on the floor.
And then the other knife you have there?
This is another cheese, and if you notice, there's a little fork prong at the end where you can pick up cheese.
Okay.
This is fine for cheeses that are a little bit softer. And you can spread it, but you can also use it for semi-hard and not quite as hard as, you know, a 15-year-old cheddar. The cheeses we have today, lovely Emmy Roth, the Grand Cru Sirchois, that took the best in show. It was crowned World Cheese Champion this year. It's a lovely cheese. It's Gruyere style. It's made by a Swiss family that goes back five generations. Cheese making in Switzerland. They decided they wanted to make cheese in America, and they came, of course, to the best place to make it in America, which is Wisconsin. The other cheese we have today is Chandoka. It's a partnership from LeClaire Farms with Standard Market. It's the cave-aged Chandoka. Now, Katie Hedrich, who is the cheesemaker at LeClaire, wowed the cheese world a couple years ago when she was crowned U.S. cheese champion with her Evalon. Chandoka is a cave-aged cheese, and it's a blend of cow and goat milk.
And so the cheese experts don't have a problem with blending two different milks.
Well, you have to really understand milk chemistry, because the fat content, the protein content, and all of the different enzymes in the different milks behave differently. You just have to know how to blend them. And it's happening, I think, more in Wisconsin than other places in the country. At least that's my observation.
Are we just more innovative?
I think we are more innovative. And I think what most people don't know about Wisconsin is, besides producing the most cheese, we also produce the most goat's milk and most cheese milk and most goat's milk and cheese milk cheeses, not just cow's milk, although, of course, cows take up a lot of our dairy in this state and make wonderful, wonderful cheeses just from cow's milk. But we also have these other dairy animals grazing, and they make great cheeses too. The last cheese, it's good you brought up goats, because this is my favorite blue blended cheese. It's by Hook's. And the name, and as you can, I can't.
So the one with a beautiful logo.
The logo of a sheep, a cow, and a goat. It's You Calf to Be Kidding Me. And it's a blue cheese, and it's wonderful, and it's also great for the holidays.
All right, so before I start salivating, we should try these. Where are we going to start?
I would start with the Chandoka.
Okay.
Yes, the right there, the one you're pointing to.
Yes. Oh, that's really nice.
It's nice. It's pungent, but not too pungent.
Right. There's something that that I think for people who might just be interested in expanding their cheese horizons, if you will, talk about the significance of why you would want something that is pungent.
Well, especially in Wisconsin, if you are drinking something stronger, if you are drinking a stronger wine or a stronger beer, you want your cheese to be able to stand up to it and not get lost. I think the Chandoka would, it's got smoky notes.
Mm-hmm.
So some sort of smoky wine or a rich, deep stout would probably go well with it.
All right.
We'll try the Grand Cru.
Hold on. I'm going to cleanse the palate here with, this is probably not an authorized beverage to cleanse the palate, but.
Well, you can pair coffee with cheese. There have actually been coffee and cheese pairing classes.
Really?
At the American Cheese Society.
Sign me up. All right, so this is the Grand Cru.
Yes, the
this
white one.
This is the world champion. And I have to say, I've been curious to try this since hearing that it became the world champion. And I believe we had them on the air.
They're fantastic. And their executive chef actually is featured in my new book.
All right, it is not difficult to understand why this is a world champion.
It's really easy to eat.
Yeah.
It also is great for, of course, making a winter fondue, mm-hmm. Gruyere, combine it with Bruce Workman's Emmentaler, and then if you can get a little bit of the Little Mountain, that would also make a really tasty Wisconsin Swiss-style fondue.
Or a very expensive grilled cheese sandwich.
Yes, yes. And why should you just use the cheapest cheddar you can buy for your grilled cheese?
I feel like if you had just the right kind of crusty bread.
Oh, yeah.
This would be terrific.
Now, normally we finish with a blue cheese, but I think because the 15-year cheddar is so special, we'll finish with that. But we will start with the You Have to Be Kidding Me. I think it's probably one of the best-named cheeses out there. Probably second to that, there's Vampire Cheese Curds, which are made not in Wisconsin. I don't remember where, but the name Vampire Cheese Curds because, of course, they have garlic.
They would be good to have with blood sausage,
yes,
too.
Yes, yes.
Oh, wow.
Isn't that creamy?
It really is. Practically melting in my mouth.
It's wonderful. And you could add a little bit of that to your grilled cheese sandwich.
Absolutely.
You can also add it to salads. One of my favorite salads made locally at Outpost, and I've learned how to make it at home, they have a maple vinaigrette, which compared with blue cheese and some dried fruit, either cherries or cranberries over spinach, with some, perhaps a few red peppers or red onion. Absolutely fantastic.
I would think that would be delicious. I feel like you were 3 for 3 with these cheeses that you brought along.
All right. Well, we've got the last one for you.
All right.
Can you see why this is so sought after?
It's interesting. It's one of those, and we're eating, this is the 15-year aged cheddar.
From Hook's.
And it's interesting, you know, you kind of ask yourself, can I tell the difference between a pretty good food and a really good food, like a pretty good steak and a really well-done steak? And with this?
Blows you away.
Yes, it really does.
Tony and Julie Hook do not enter this in any competitions because they don't produce it in vast quantities. And it takes a lot of time and money to age it for 15 years. The other thing Tony told me when I interviewed him for my first cheese book, The Cheeses of Wisconsin, A Culinary Travel Guide, is that as a cheesemaker, you have to know which cheeses will age out well. Because usually if there are problems in a cheese, they will show up the longer you age
right.
it. Some cheeses are okay. They're not great. But if you eat them fresh, they're fine. But as you age them, that's when the problems would come. So you have to know where the milk came from. And Tony will pick which farms he wants which milks to be used for. He knows all of his suppliers that well that, you know, I will use this for a blue cheese or I will use this for an earlier cheddar or I'll use this one for cheese curds.
Is there a little crunch in there?
There is. Those are the little calcium crystallization that happens with age. And I don't think that's the technical term, but it just is so wonderful. It's crunchy,
gosh.
And It's one of those that you taste and you can savor, and the aroma stays in your mouth long after you've taken a bite. It's one of those you really have to savor.
I'm glad you saved this for last.
I thought it was worth saving.
Well, Jeanette Hurt, unlike the cheese, I feel very spoiled now. Thank you so much for bringing in these great cheeses, and hope to see you again soon.
Definitely.
Jeanette Hurt is a Milwaukee-based food writer. Her books include The Cheeses of Wisconsin and her latest, Drink Like a Woman. You can find out how to win a copy of that one at WUWM.com.
That's also where you can find a link to more about a couple of pop-up dinners Jeanette will host at Great Lakes Distillery with Chef Anna Docta in early December.
Speaking of drinks, we'll switch our taste buds over to the beverage side of things with the proprietors of an artisan tonic company based here in Milwaukee when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Before the break, we tasted some cheese along with food writer Jeanette Hurt. We will invoke the equal time provision now and switch to beverages.
Milwaukee has a long brewing tradition, of course. More recently, the city's become home to a variety of spirit distilleries. But a local company is now getting noticed for making the stuff that gets mixed into spirits, the tea in your G&T.
Mary Pelletieri and Noah Swanson are both experienced hands in the beverage world, and they founded Top Note Tonics a couple of years ago. They brought their line of mixers in for a tasting recently. It was a somewhat tricky proposition for a radio host who does not drink, so we had some WUWM colleagues stop by and join us in the studio as well. Mary Pelletieri gives us a little background on just what the company makes.
Tonic as a category has been kind of a lost category in the soft drink aisle, and we designed Top Note to be a change of direction for that. Specifically, broadening the category in flavor as well as some complexity. Top Note is based off of old traditional European-style tonics from a bitter orange, a bitter lemon, and a bitter lime. And we also have a Indian tonic, which a lot of people ask, what the heck is that? That's actually a traditional tonic that was more dry and used to does taste better with gin. So it's a great spin on an old world tonic.
So if these are the old world spins on tonics, what is the typical American spin that you're getting away from?
Well, I came from craft beer. I have 20 some years of craft beer experience, and I saw that revolution happen where you went from really lager and light beer being the only two types of beer in the beer world to something that was a throwback, right? So ales, sour beers, all those styles of beers that came back with craft beer were really just a throwback to what had happened prior to the beverage business. So we see that happening in soft drinks now. So it's what's old is new again, to long story short. And it's happening really in every beverage category.
All right. Well, take us through what we're going to try first.
Sure. I think we'll make you up a ginger beer since you want to try some non-alcoholic products first. The ginger beer can be consumed as an NA, and we like to encourage that, obviously, for responsible drinking, but also for people that may be at a party that want to not consume. Ginger beer is actually a nice product to do that with. You can make this less sweet, so, you know, if you're reaching for the ginger ale because your stomach is a little full, ginger beer is actually a nice alternative to that because you can, with syrups, at least control the sugar. Real ginger beer should have real ginger in it. Traditionally, it was called ginger beer because it was effervescent from re-fermentation in the bottle. Obviously, we don't do that with our syrups. We just provide you the real pressed ginger. It's darker with a dark Belgian candy sugar made from dates, and it actually has some grapefruit peel in there, so there's some nice botanicals in these. A lot of complexity, but we call it ginger beer because we agree ginger ale was more of a light, effervescent version of ginger beer. Ginger beer is that more robust version of a gingery drink. It's like root beer, but with ginger. So that's usually what we tell people.
Although, do I see there is an alcoholic spin on this that is also being made in the studio right now?
We will make a Moscow Mule with this. So why don't you guys taste it as a ginger beer and
Yeah, I mixed up some mules here and a couple of just straight ginger beer.
Oh, wow.
So our ginger, all of our products are about half the sugar of a typical mixer. One of the problems we see with commercial mixers is they're far too sweet. And whereas it's easy to add sugar to a drink, getting sweetness out of a drink is very tough. And a lot of bartenders who try to dry up their drink may pour a little more heavily with the alcohol. And it kind of, things can get out of balance kind of quickly. So we think that's just the best starting place for quality cocktails.
Mayan Silver is in the studio with the Moscow Mule. What's your reaction over there?
It's really nice. It was a good level of alcohol and flavor. It was not too sweet.
The ginger definitely comes through more than any kind of sweetness to it. It strikes me that this is the kind of ginger beer that you would sort of linger over.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Right. And we should note that what you made for me here was carbonated because you added seltzer to it.
Correct. So these are usually mixed down one part of the syrup to five parts of the soda water. It could be soda water, seltzer. It could be a soda stream if you happen to have one of those at home. I think we'll make the fake fashion next. What do you think?
All right.
The fake old fashioned. Everyone needs to know what an old fashioned tastes like. We're going to make this a bit more cherry forward for you.
Well, and tell me what you have in there.
This is our bitter orange syrup, and we actually are just using some Door County cherries in here to give it some tartness and some soda water. And let me taste that first, as a good bartender should. It's pretty tasty. I think you'll like that.
All right.
So there will be a little bitterness to this. This is a tonic, but we tried to make this a balanced tonic. Bitter orange is a soft drink that they drink in Europe for the digestive properties of the bitterness as well as the aperitivo qualities. It helps cleanse your palate, as they say, get you ready for a meal. And actually the herbs that we use in here are considered really good for digestion. So there's some old school medicinal qualities to tonic. We don't like to necessarily promote these as medicinal. They really are a soft drink syrup or a mixer syrup. So we like to encourage people to drink responsibly. But there is, some people find it refreshing that there's actual real herbal qualities to these.
All right. Well, so let me ask you a dumb question then. Do I drink it through the straw?
Go ahead, drink it through the straw.
Right.
It's not
all
a dumb question.
So, old school paper straw.
Oh, wow. That is nice.
You like that?
I would drink that.
Uh-huh. And you can look like you're drinking an old-fashioned.
That's exactly. You know, that's the trick to non-drinking in Wisconsin. Find something that looks like a drink.
So we're going to make the folks that want to imbibe a gin old-fashioned. Mm. And the gin what we're using is the Ray Horst barrel-aged gin. Gin old-fashioned is actually the first old-fashioned, and people don't realize that because we're so used to more of like a brandy old-fashioned here. So I'm going to mix about 1.5 parts of the gin to one part. Actually, we'll do about 1.25 parts of the tonic syrup, and then we're just going to add our soda water on top.
The orange has a lot of warm spices. It's the most kind of herbal complex one that we make. Cardamom and clove, even a little bit of molasses, two different kinds of peel. No actual juice in there, but it certainly kind of lends itself to more cold seasonal drinks.
We should not be looking to this for our vitamin C.
Right. Won't find it in there.
Isn't that great?
Yes. Yeah. Really light.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, old fashions tend to get kind of heavy with a lot of sugar. This is a drier version, more classic version of old fashioned. So fun to use as orange as an old fashioned base. And actually, we have some great accounts that are doing that now, including the Wicked Hop downtown. So. And should we go for one more with the traditional gin
always,
and tonic?
You know, my favorite has always been the gentian lime. It's unique in that. It's a quinine-free tonic, so instead of being bittered with quinine, and we use the natural source of quinine, which is cinchona bark, traditionally from South America, We use gentian root, which is the same bitter that shows up in most cocktail bitters, Campari, Aperol, and vermouths. And just about any aperitivo or digestivo has gentian in it. So it's a different bitter. It's earthier because it is a root rather than a bark. It's slightly licorice-y. And I like it on its own as a kind of a dry, refreshing seltzer. But it also is a kind of an interesting base to mix some with tequila. It's actually quite good. Or kind of the more American version of botanical tonics, which tend to be a little bit lighter on the juniper.
So this is, this gin and tonic, which these ladies will be trying, it's almost like a gin and ginger, because this tonic, or gentian tonic, is very gingery. But you'll notice the bitterness is more earthy. It's not as strong as quinine.
I feel like we need Snoop Dogg around here.
He's coming to Milwaukee.
That's right.
And so if they're drinking a G&T, what am I drinking here?
The non-alcoholic.
Okay.
Just tonic on its own.
Okay. So like a J&T.
This is great.
I used to drink tonic when I was little. My mom would have a gin and tonic, and I would just take the tonic.
The nice thing about a tonic syrup is that it allows you to control that sugar. And usually you can make a drier drink with it where you can actually taste the quality of the gin.
I have to say, this is amazing. Not that I have done a lot of tasting of tonics in the past, but any kind of tasting, you know, they always say you can tell that it's earthy or piquant or what have you, but it really is earthy.
Yes.
I mean, I totally get it.
Yeah.
And it's really pleasant.
So the word top note comes from the aromas, or there's ephemeral aromas that you get usually from spirits. It's a term that's used when describing flavor. I just thought it was appropriate as these are highly complex tonics that it really meets that name pretty darn well. These have wonderful top notes of pepper or citrus or ginger. Those are the wonderful characters of these tonics.
Mary Pelletieri and Noah Swanson are the founders of Milwaukee-based Top Note Tonics. You'll find some winter drink recipes they shared with us at WUWM.com. Special thanks to our tasting panel, which included Mayan Silver, Michelle Maternowski, and my co-host this morning, Joy Powers.
Before we go today, we'll leave you with our monthly segment with local musician John Seeger. He joins us this morning for a special edition of the Monthly Beatdown. It's a song called No One to Thank But Myself.
No one to thank but myself. No one to thank but me. Foot was in the crosshairs and I turned my shot. Made myself some homemade misery. Can't thank the Lord, can't thank my luck. Might not be anybody else. Can't shift the blame, can't pass the buck. Looks like I got to thank myself. No one to thank but myself. No one to thank but me. Foot was in the crosshairs and I took my shot. Made myself some homemade misery. That's too bad, that's so sad. All you got to do is understand. Beating on yourself makes you mad. Why don't you just give yourself a hand? No one to thank. for myself. No one to thank but me. Foot within the crosshairs, and I took my shot. Made myself some homemade misery. Only a fool breaks his own heart, sits there stewing in his misery. Got all the tools to make a new start. Might need a change of scenery. No one to thank but myself. No one to thank but me. Foot was in the crosshairs and I took my shot. Made myself some homemade misery. Made myself some homemade misery.
John Seeger and a host of other musicians with No One to Thank But Myself, a Thanksgiving Day edition of the Monthly Beatdown with John Seeger. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke, hoping you have things for which to be thankful today.
And I'm Joy Powers. We're thankful you're listening today and hope you can be with us again tomorrow morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
It's 11 o'clock and stay tuned because Fresh Air is next.